Airplane Intel Podcast, Episode 91. This time, we interview AMPIA Dean Showalter to get an introduction to aircraft maintenance for airplane owners.
Here's three basic things that I would say. Learn all you can. Don't buy more airplane than you can afford. And get involved in the maintenance process. And if you can do those things, then that will definitely give you a head start in having a safe airplane and being able to enjoy it and even enjoy some of the maintenance.
We'll cover everything you need to know about maintenance, from inspections and overhauls to preventative and owner-assisted maintenance to upgrades and STCs, plus how to save money with your aircraft's maintenance.
That's something that you should talk about. You should ask in advance. Don't ask on the tail end when you get the invoice, can you take off X amount of dollars? Ask that in the beginning.
If you're an airplane owner or plan to become one, you won't want to miss this.
Are you an aircraft owner, pilot, or mechanic? Do you want to learn how to increase safety, reduce risk, and save money with your airplane? Then you are in the right place. This is the Airplane Intel Podcast, the only show that tells you how to make aircraft ownership simple, safe, and cost-effective. Featuring the pre-buy guys and brought to you by CoFlight.com. We bring over 100 years combined experience flying, maintaining, and managing all types of aircraft. If you're ready to make smarter decisions and get more out of your airplane, stay tuned.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Airplane Intel Podcast. We're an aviation podcast that focuses on the ins and outs of airplane ownership. I'm Adam. I'm a CFII, AMPIA, and the president of Airplane Intel, Inc. If you're new to the show, welcome aboard. It's great to have you along for the ride. And if you're a longtime listener, welcome back. It's great to see you again. On the show, we compare airplanes, interview airplane owners and industry experts, and of course, share our real-world experiences as professional pilots and mechanics working in the field every day with airplane buyers and owners. It's my goal to help you make safer and smarter decisions when it comes to buying, maintaining, and managing your personal or business aircraft. Be sure to hit that subscribe button right now on whatever podcast player you're listening from so you won't miss an episode. You can also check out all of our past episodes, show notes, and other free resources at airplaneintelpodcast.com. And while you're there, you can send us your questions and feedback by using the contact form or leaving us a voicemail using the SpeakPipe app right there on the website. Now, as I sit here to record today's episode, I'm finding it almost difficult to believe that it's already the middle of December. I mean, where did the time go this year? Seriously. Now, I know it's been a tough year for many of us, but we all have a lot to be grateful for. I'm extremely grateful for you and your continued support and listenership of this podcast. I'm also grateful to all of our Patreon supporters that have generously contributed to the show this year. So without all of you, this show would simply not be possible, and it certainly wouldn't be very fun. So thank you so much for all of your support. Now, speaking of Patreon, I'd like to welcome our latest Patreon supporter, Josh McElhattan, who is a client of ours that recently purchased his first airplane, a Cirrus SR-22 G6. So, Josh, it's been great working with you, and thank you for all your generous support to the show. On a final note, Sarah and I are eagerly awaiting the arrival of our first child, Amelia. She could be here any day now, any time, actually. You know, my phone is right here next to me just in case I get the call. And without a doubt, that's the greatest Christmas gift anyone can ask for. So we're extremely excited about that. I'm also extremely excited about today's topic. You know, this podcast is all about aircraft ownership, and like it or not, maintenance is an inevitable part of ownership. Unfortunately, maintenance is often the most expensive and misunderstood aspect of ownership as well. It's often the source of anxiety and frustration and contention. However, with the right knowledge and a good team on your side, it doesn't have to be that way. The truth is, your aircraft requires maintenance regardless of how much it flies. All aircraft must comply with scheduled inspections, such as annual inspections, phases, or letter checks. They must also comply with the replacement of life-limited parts, such as landing gear assemblies or engine components or safety equipment. And of course, aircraft will inevitably require unscheduled maintenance, such as troubleshooting and component repair, component replacements, and servicing. In other words, there's no way around aircraft maintenance. Now, for most of us, aircraft maintenance is overwhelmingly mind-numbing. It can be both complex as well as convoluted. Some maintenance is only performed on condition, while other cases, it is accomplished at specific schedules, such as hourly or by calendar date or by cycles. Likewise, some maintenance events are required by regulation, while others are mere recommendations. Knowing what maintenance to complete and when is vital to keeping your aircraft safe, compliant, and airworthy. Now, the next hurdle to overcome is finding a qualified, capable, and competent maintenance provider to perform the maintenance on your aircraft. Some maintenance providers are certified by the FAA as a repair station under FAR Part 145, while others operate under the less restrictive FAR Part 43. How do you know which shops you can trust and which ones to run away from? In today's interview, we're going to cover everything you need to know about maintenance as an airplane owner. We'll help you understand what maintenance is required versus what is recommended, show you where to find maintenance and inspection information for your airplane, demystify some common terminology used in aircraft maintenance, give you some advice on how to select a quality mechanic, and show you ways to save money on your maintenance with preventative maintenance as well as owner-assisted maintenance, plus a lot more. Our guest today is Dean Showalter, and honestly, I can't think of a better guest for this topic. I consider Dean a great friend of mine. He's probably the nicest AMPIA I've ever met, and he's also extremely knowledgeable and experienced when it comes to maintaining GA aircraft. Dean has been fixing and flying a large variety of piston-powered airplanes in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia for 27 years. As an AMPIA and pilot who loves airplanes and people, Dean has found there's an endless supply of adventure and inspiration in general aviation. Dean is also the host of the Airplane Owner Maintenance Podcast, which has put him in touch with so many amazing people around the country and beyond. In fact, that's how I met Dean, was through his podcast. So I'm really excited for our conversation today. So without further ado, let's get right into today's interview. Today, we're speaking with my friend, fellow podcaster, and ANPIA, Dean Showalter. Hey, Dean, welcome back to the podcast.
Hey, Adam, it's great to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been really excited to talk to you for a while. I know we've been going back and forth and trying to get you back on, but you were on the podcast way back, I think it was episode 20, which is going back a long ways now. But tell us a little bit more about yourself, your career in aviation for those that might be meeting you for the first time.
Yeah, I'll be happy to. I had an uncle that was involved in general aviation, and he was a pilot mainly, but he was also an A&P, and he did a lot of corporate flying through his career. And maybe he was a catalyst to my aviation interest. And I had an off and on interest in aviation growing up. And then I won't go through all the details, but in 1991, I married Maria. And so she was fresh out of nursing school. And we moved off to Tennessee, where I was attending aviation school, and she paid my way through aviation school working as a home health nurse. So I'm always indebted to her for that. And so I got my A&P, my private instrument and commercial certificates there. And we moved back here to the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia in 1994. And that's when I started working at Classic Aviation in the shop there as an A&P. Did some flying along the way. And in the summer of 95, I got my multi-engine rating in a Piper Apache. And a little fun story on that, I thought I was probably doing okay when I discovered the examiner had fallen asleep in the pattern. So that was kind of a fun story there. Wow. And that's a good memory. And so progressed on. And then in the year 2000, I got my CFI certificate. I haven't done a lot of flight instruction, but I still renew it every 2 years. I went to the Baker School in Tennessee and got my IA, my inspection authorization. And I had been doing lots of inspections up to that point because I could do that under the repair station at Classic Aviation, but I still wanted to get the certificate. So I did that in 2009. And then probably the funnest thing I've done in my career is I started the Airplane Owner Maintenance Podcast in 2015. And that's how I met you. And I was looking back and it was about this time, November of 2016, about 5 years ago, that you sent me an email. And that began a friendship. And I've always appreciated your encouragement and everything that you're doing up to this point. So I'm sure there'll be more to come, but that's kind of my history. And I'm still working at Classic Aviation in the shop over here and producing the podcast and looking for more aviation adventures in the future. There's always more adventures out there.
Oh, of course. And man, there's so much to pick apart just with your background. First of all, your wife sounds like a wonderful woman. And that's really amazing that she was so supportive of you to pursue your dreams and look where you are today. And it's pretty incredible. I'm sure you didn't think back then that this is where you'd be today doing what you're doing.
No, absolutely not. No, no idea.
Yeah.
I didn't even know what a podcast was until right around that time. Soon before that time, people would talk about this term podcast, and I had this very vague idea about something audio, but yeah.
Interesting. Well, and I can't believe you just reminded me too that it's been about 5 years since we started corresponding with each other, and time really does fly, doesn't it?
Wow, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. And yeah, it was you and Don Sebastian was very, very much in touch with me in the early years. He would send me audio messages and he was always so encouraging. And honestly, I'm sorry that we lost him here very recently. And I regret that I did not meet him in person. I wish I could have done that, but what a great man.
Yes, he absolutely was. And definitely my mentor through my early career coming out of the military and all that. And similar to Maria, I owe some, I'm indebted to Don in a lot of ways as well for what he's taught me
yes.
and how I was able to progress into what we're doing today. So it's interesting how that works. And of course, I'm very grateful for it as well. Well, I'm really excited to talk about this with you because maintenance is so important in aviation as a whole, but it's really important for airplane owners. And Dean, you've been involved in maintenance and aviation for a long time. So I'm sure you've seen the spectrum of the good, the bad, the ugly when it comes to airplane owners, how they approach maintenance, how airplanes are maintained, all that sort of stuff. And you know, I think maintenance is a source of anxiety and frustration for a lot of people. There's a lot of different things that can happen in a maintenance event. There's a lot of uncertainty. What are some things that an owner can do to better prepare themselves when it comes to maintaining the airplane, which is, of course, an inevitable element of ownership?
Yes, that's a great question because you're right. It can be overwhelming and it can be a little daunting, but I have learned actually to enjoy it quite a bit. When I got out of A&P school, I really thought I wanted to fly more. And I got a job as an A&P because that's what I could get a job doing at the time. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a lot of flying time, 300 and some hours. So I've learned to enjoy it. And that's what I would like to encourage people to do is find the ways to enjoy it. But if I was going to boil it down, I was thinking about this. And here's three basic things that I would say. Learn all you can. Don't buy more airplane than you can afford and get involved in the maintenance process. And if you can do those things, then that will definitely give you a head start in having a safe airplane and being able to enjoy it and even enjoy some of the maintenance if you're so inclined.
That's great advice. And I think that speaks volumes because the more educated the owner is, the more involved they are, the less expensive, the less frustrating, the less uncertain all the inevitable maintenance becomes. And that starts with what we're doing right now, right? We're trying to get folks kind of oriented to this world of maintenance, which is, in a lot of cases, a mystery to most people. I guess let's start by defining some terms. I mean, we're saying the term maintenance somewhat loosely here, but maintenance involves a lot of different things. You know, we have maintenance, we have inspections, we have alterations, we have major and minor repairs. You know, people have heard of things like airworthiness directives, and the list goes on. Can we start defining some of these terms, Dean? Like, what is maintenance exactly? What are inspections? What's preventative maintenance?
Well, whenever I am able to, I like to really make things as simple as possible. And so you can bring out some more details here as you see the need to do so. But in really simple terms, to me, maintenance has more to do with doing and fixing. And inspection has more to do with looking and checking. So that's some dividing lines that I see between maintenance and inspections. There's a whole lot more to it, but what are your thoughts on that?
No, that I totally agree with you. And I think that sometimes maintenance stands alone by itself, like, hey, you need to change that tire or service that strut. And then other times maintenance is a result of an inspection because you find a discrepancy or a squawk on the airplane. And I think that that makes perfect sense. We get questions, I'm sure you do too, like, well, what's this annual inspection going to cost? Well, it's like, well, are we talking about the inspection or are we talking about the inspection plus whatever discrepancies we find? And so I think that that hits the nail on the head. And of course, there's this other element of preventative maintenance, and that's sprinkled into the regulations. It's something that is mentioned at seminars and things like that. Can you briefly describe what preventative maintenance is and how an owner might be able to get involved in that?
Preventive maintenance is something that The FAA established a specific list of items, and it's in Part 43 of the regulations, Appendix A, Paragraph C, covers that list. And it has things like changing the oil in the engine, changing tires, cleaning and replacing screens in the engine or the fuel system, different things like that. So preventive maintenance is something that an airplane owner or operator can do with the FAA's approval and sign it off themselves as long as they are a certificated pilot. You have to have at least a private pilot certificate to do that. So it's a great way for an airplane owner to get involved in the maintenance of their own airplane. But one of the really important things is to not just launch out and say, oh, I can do all this stuff now, mm-hmm. but to connect up with somebody who's done it before and learn from them right alongside them, either your A&P or maybe a fellow airplane owner who is very familiar with the process. But yeah, preventive maintenance is a great thing. And I love the concept because I always enjoy seeing airplane owners who are heavily involved in the maintenance of their airplane. And that's one of the ways that they can be.
Absolutely. It's a great stepping stone for the owner to be more involved. And it's a lot of times a great first step. But like you said, you know, word of caution is make sure that you're getting the training on how to do those tasks on your specific airplane before you just haphazardly start pulling the cowling and pulling filters off and all this. It does take a little bit of training. Not much though. I think one, you know, oil change, you can learn one in one shot probably, but so that's interesting. Now there's also these concepts that people have, I'm sure, heard, and we don't have to go into too much detail, but things like major and minor alterations and major and minor repairs. Can we discuss those items a little bit just to kind of clear the air with some folks that might not be familiar with it?
Well, first of all, the terms major and minor kind of give an indicator of what it's all about. So a major repair or a major alteration is going to be something that's more complex or more involved, whereas a minor one is going to have a lot less significance. So for example, maybe you have an old airplane that had a generator as the means for generating electrical power, and you're going to take the generator off and put an alternator on, which will be able to produce a lot more electrical power. That's a significant change to the electrical system. So that's going to be a major alteration. Whereas probably adding, say, a second cigarette lighter adapter in your panel would be more of a minor alteration. One of the big keys that divides the two is who is able to sign them off. Mm-hmm. So a minor alteration or repair can be signed off by an A&P, someone with an A&P certificate, whereas with a major repair, major alteration, many times, all the time, they will need to be signed off by either someone with an inspection authorization, the IA, or a repair station or manufacturer and things like that. But those are some of the things that come to mind for major and minor. The major alterations, most of the time, they will have an STC, a supplemental type certificate, that are connected with them. And that will be the approved data that is used for making that major alteration to the airplane.
Yes. Yes, that's an excellent point. And that is another component, a box to check, so to speak, is that you would have a STC most likely for a major alteration. And the other thing too, and I'm sure, you know, people that have listened to our podcasts before and people that have been around might have heard of the idea of submitting a FAA Form 337, and that is a required form in most cases for major alterations and major repairs as well. And so that's another thing that people need to remember to do when a major alteration is being done. Now, speaking of STC, Supplemental Type Certificate, can you briefly describe what that is and how that applies to aircraft maintenance?
Sure. The STC is something that is added to an airplane. So when it comes off the assembly line, the airplane has been manufactured according to the type certificate data sheet. And then when you make a major alteration, when you have an STC, a supplemental type certificate, it is something that is added to the original type certificate. And then that becomes part of the specifications for that airplane from then on.
Exactly. It's like a permanently installed piece of equipment or avionics or whatever. And now that's part of that specific airplane and its history, and it's part of its spec sheet, like you say. I'll put a link in the show notes for how to access the type certificate data sheet that you mentioned, Dean, as well as the STC database on the FAA site, because there's a lot of interesting things there. And what's important to note is that equipment becomes part of that airplane. So that equipment needs to be operative, and you need all the paperwork to back up the installation. So the STC certificate, maybe a flight manual supplement, and so on. So that's important to distinguish there. Now, real quick, can we talk about airworthiness directives? Because that's another big thing that people need to know about and understand.
Sure, yes. Airworthiness directives are something that are really important. And I think of them as, when people think of the automotive world, they think of the recalls. You get that letter and something's been recalled. An AD is kind of like a recall for airplanes. It's been discovered along the way that something has been a problem in the past, maybe for multiple airplanes. And so the FAA issues an airworthiness directive, which is, it is absolutely mandatory. It's not an optional thing. So ADs are something that is necessary to keep up with. And it's the owner or operator's primarily their responsibility to make sure they are done. And then also the inspector who is doing the annual inspection on the airplane is going to be heavily involved in that process as well to make sure everything is up to date. And I have to say, one of my pet peeves is when people come in and their AD records are scattered all over the place. And it seems like most of the airplanes are that way for some reason.
Yes.
So if you want to do your inspector a favor and really impress them, then just go through all your AD records and sort out all the past records that you have. Come up with one clear, concise, complete set of AD records. It might take you some hours, but keep in mind, if you don't spend the hours, then your inspector will have to spend the hours.
Yes.
So I always love it when people come in, that rare case, I will say, when people come in with excellent AD records. But yes, it's very important.
You brought up a few good points there. And one thing for sure that is often overlooked is that you need to have the ADs complied with for the airframe, the engine, the propeller, and any appliances that might apply. So a lot of folks, you say, oh, well, I didn't see any ADs. And it's like, well, you didn't see ADs on that engine because you weren't looking for them. So it's important, you know, people need to realize that you should have records both in the law books and potentially on a AD compliance form that you're covering the airframe, the engine, the propeller, and any appliances. And the other point that you brought up that I love is you're right. Most of these airplanes come in with ADs just in a logbook, and you have to go through maybe 20 years more of the logbook just to see when the last time this AD was complied with or if it's applicable or whatever. And yeah, you can do your mechanic and yourself really a favor by getting things organized, because it's going to save you some money in the long run. Because I know, you know, we spend hours when we're getting a new airplane here that we have to research the ADs and all this. And if the owner was, you know, understood what they were looking for and was able to put everything together in a little bit more organized way, it would save everyone some time and save them some money. So that's really good advice. What about overhauls? That's another big thing that occurs with airplanes over time and with engines. How, first of all, what are some of the terms that we use to describe overhauls, and what is an overhaul? How is it different than maintenance or inspections? And what are some things that people should know about overhauls?
Well, one thing, first of all, it's probably important to understand what an overhaul is. And many times in logbooks and maintenance records, the term overhaul has been used inappropriately. Like mm-hmm. You might even see someone will say, overhauled the nose landing gear strut. And what they really mean is they took it apart, they cleaned it and put it back together with new seals and serviced it. Mm-hmm. But that's not an overhaul. That's a repair or a reseal. So that's not an overhaul. But as far as the term overhaul, many times it's used for different things, different appliances, but mainly the term is often associated with engines and propellers and major components like that. So when it comes to engines, there are different levels of overhauls, and you might hear the term field overhaul. And that just means that the overhaul was done somewhere in the field that's not the manufacturer. So it might be actually an A&P can overhaul an engine. And so it might be that an A&P does that. That doesn't happen too often. Many times it is, say, an engine specialty shop that might do that, or one that is connected with the manufacturer in some way. And so that's an overhaul. When an overhaul is done, then the engine retains its time and service as it goes through that overhaul and continues on. So that would be the term overhaul. And it can be overhauled to new or to serviceable limits when it's done. But when the manufacturer overhauls an engine, they can call it rebuilt. And when they do that, then they can zero time the engine. So it starts over at zero time as if it was a new engine. And many times this is kind of nice because then you can say your engine only has X amount of hours on it. However, it's also something to be careful about as well, because that engine could have parts in it then that are significantly old, really. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you had, say, a first run engine that only had 2,000 hours on it, it might be advantageous to have that one overhauled and just continue it in service, because it may have less time on it than the quote zero time one. So those are just a few thoughts that I have on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing too is that the cost of the overhaul is going to vary depending on where it goes to be done. Of course, if you send it to a engine shop, like you were mentioning, a repair station that specializes in engine overhauls, or to your local A&P that has experience and the tooling to do the overhaul, might cost different than if you were to send it to the factory to do a factory overhaul. And then that factory rebuild, or often referred to in slang terminology, the factory remanufacture or the remand engine, then that's going to be a lot more expensive than if you were just to do a field overhaul. So that's some things to keep in mind on the ownership side. And of course, keep in mind when you're in the market for an airplane, because the different overhaul types or categories will influence maybe the asking price of the airplane. And then, of course, like you were just mentioning, I've seen this many times as well, where you get a rebuilt engine and it's zero timed or very low time. And then you look in the 8130 where the rebuild was done, and you find out that engine case has 7,000 hours on it or something crazy.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, well, but the owner doesn't know that, probably, you know? So that's the work order and the 8130 for that engine, if it is a remand engine, should tell you what the hours are on that component, on the case and some of the other components, and as well as the status of were things overhauled, replaced with new, replaced with serviceable, and so on and so forth. So you get a lot of information from that logbook entry regarding the status. And I've also seen it where the listing for a new, you know, an airplane for sale might say that it's a remanufactured engine, but you look through the logs and it's a factory overhaul, which is a little different. So the terminology does matter, because it does, you know, in the context of buying an airplane, it influences the value quite a bit. So I appreciate you clarifying that, because, you know, like you say, there's this field overhaul, the factory remanufacture. Of course, you can get engines from STC'd engines from Ram or from Continental or whatever. And then one more thing I wanted to ask you about is this concept of top overhaul. And, you know, just yesterday I was looking at a 182 that had a top overhaul done about 200 hours ago. And, you know, top overhauls are great, but, you know, for those that might not be familiar, what is a top overhaul?
Yeah, a top overhaul is not really an FAA term. It's just a term that is kind of an industry understood term to mean that all the cylinders were removed from that engine and overhauled and put back on. I'm not a big fan of top overhauls, because many times they are done because somebody might say, I think it's some erroneous thinking, but a mechanic or an IA, they're like a lot of things in aviation, there are a lot of opinions around this. Mm-hmm. And they might say, well, you had a cylinder taken off last year, and now you've got two more cylinders that need to be removed. You might as well go ahead and do them all. Well, there's some risks with taking all the cylinders off an engine. If you take all the cylinders off an engine, then you have to be extremely careful to put proper preload tension back on the through bolts before you move the prop, because you can have the risk of shifting a bearing in there, which down the road can cause some catastrophic failure. So really, if you really think about it, each cylinder on one of these piston engines is like its own separate little appliance. And so you wouldn't say, oh, well, since the starter is having a problem, let's go ahead and remove the alternator also. Well, in some cases you might, if it's got, say, 1,000 hours on it. But I like the concept of seeing each cylinder as its own appliance. And when it has a problem, then yes, by all means, take it off if we have to and fix it and put it back on. But yeah, top overhaul is kind of a term that's just used as to refer to all the cylinders were removed, repaired, or overhauled and put back on.
That's a great description, and I totally agree with you with your thoughts on whether a top overhaul is appropriate or not, and how each cylinder is its own individual component and should be treated as such. And, you know, I totally agree with you on that. And I'm a proponent of not removing cylinders unless absolutely necessary. And we can talk about this a little later if you want, but, you know, you've perfected kind of this way of saving cylinders from being removed unnecessarily, which is fascinating. And I'm sure you've seen it, especially in the older airplanes, that cylinders are getting replaced sometimes every 50 hours, 100 hours, every year, whatever, you know, and they're just going down the line. And it's like, well, was that really necessary, honestly, you know? And in most cases, it probably isn't. But the thing that, well, the takeaway that I got from you for sure is the risk involved in doing unnecessary cylinder replacement or pulling all the cylinders with the bearing spinning. I mean, that is a real risk that might not be seen immediately either. So that's a great point, and I hope people listen to that, because there's a lot of folks out there that just think, yeah, we'll just replace the cylinder, it'll be fine. It's like, well, hold on a second. Some of our listeners might already know this. Some may not exactly realize it because they're new to ownership or perhaps not owners yet. But the FAA places the burden of maintaining airworthiness onto the owner or operator, and that's outlined in FAR 91403. So it's critical that owners have a solid understanding as to what their responsibilities are when it comes to maintenance. So we kind of alluded to it already, but who is authorized to perform maintenance on an aircraft? Because it's not as black and white as people might think. There's different people that are allowed to do various things. So can you briefly describe that for us?
Sure. Well, obviously an A&P is authorized to perform maintenance, at least to a lot of the levels, and they can do certain things, many things actually. And then someone with an inspection authorization would be required to sign off the annual inspection. And so an A&P can sign off a 100-hour inspection and many of the repairs that are done. And then the IA needs to sign the annual. You can also work on an airplane if you are supervised by an A&P. So that's kind of another little level that I think oftentimes that tends to happen in various levels. And there's probably some debate about what it means to be supervised. Mm-hmm. And right. I think one of the huge things that is missed all over the place, probably almost across the board, is that when a person is doing maintenance that's not preventive maintenance, and they're being supervised by an A&P, their name is supposed to go in the logbook. Well, how many times have you seen a name in the logbook? I mean, I hardly ever see that. So that's an interesting thing.
That's a great point.
And then owner pilots then can also, owners and operators can also sign off preventive maintenance as long as it meets that criteria. So those are some of the different levels.
Yes, absolutely. So by sign off, what do you mean by sign off?
There are regulations about what needs to be done. And it's 91417, the records must include a description of the work performed, the date of completion, and the signature and certificate of the person approving the aircraft for return to service. So when I say sign off, that's kind of what I mean, is signing the maintenance record entry that is done as part of that work.
Excellent. Yeah. And it's so important. And I've seen, I'm sure you have too, on occasion where you have the owner pilot signing off work that they're not allowed to do technically. That's interesting. And, you know, that could present some issues potentially depending on what it is and how recent it was and if it had been superseded by another maintenance event. But I think that's another key thing. You know, if just a tip for folks going through their own logbooks or going through logbooks on an airplane they're looking to buy, make sure that most recent annual inspection has a signature from an IA. I mean, I've seen that before where it's signed off as a 100-hour by an A&P or it's signed off as an annual by an A&P that doesn't have the IA and the certificate number. And, you know, by definition, it's not a valid sign-off and therefore not a current annual. So that's something to look at. And, of course, repair stations. We touched on that a little bit. Can you briefly just describe what's the difference between a repair station and just a maintenance shop that may be operating under Part 43?
Yes, a repair station is under a higher level of scrutiny by the FAA. And so it's like a more reputable level of maintenance kind of, although honestly, I think there are, to be fair, I think there are a lot of A&Ps, IAs, small shops that are not a repair station, and they are actually putting out some better quality work than some of the repair stations out there. But it's an FAA designation that gives you certain privileges. Like one of the privileges is that you can have a roster of inspectors who have their A&P, and even though they don't have the inspection authorization, they can sign off annual inspections as long as it's done under the repair station. So it's another level of certification with the FAA, and I'm sure there are airplane owners that really want to see that and have the assurance that when they take their airplane to a repair station, they're getting a better level of service, even though that's not always the case, in my opinion.
Well said, and totally agree. And so I guess the easiest way for maybe the pilots to understand is being a 145 repair station is like going to a Part 141 flight school, where they have a lot of oversight from the FAA and specific procedures and requirements that they must meet to maintain their certificate. And yeah, I think a lot of folks that are buying newer airplanes like using the service centers, for example, like a Cirrus service center or a Cessna service center. And typically those are repair stations that have some sort of affiliation with the manufacturer. And so they're operating under their repair station license. But as you say, there's folks that are in that shop that probably aren't even A&Ps. And there's inspectors in that shop that aren't necessarily IAs. Not saying that's a bad thing, but it can present some problems. Now, there's occasions where you have to have a repair station license to do certain work, you know, like instrument repair or propeller repair, for example. Most engine shops are repair stations, avionics shops. There's varying degrees of these repair stations, and there's limitations as well. There's a point in which a repair station can't do things that are outside of the privileges or allowances that the FAA gives. Going back to the original question, that's the exception to the rule. If you are bringing your airplane to a repair station and the sign-off for the annual, let's say, is done with the repair station license, the inspector in that repair station, then you don't need that IA signature to return the airplane to service. So it's one of those technicalities, formalities, whatever, but I can see it being a source of confusion for folks that may not be familiar. So, you know, you brought up some of the FARs. I brought up 91403, you brought up 91417. So let's talk about some of the FARs that govern aircraft maintenance and inspections. And these are things that owners need to know. These aren't all the regulations, of course, but these are some of the things that owners need to know. So I already mentioned 91403, which is the responsibilities for the owner to be responsible for the airworthiness of the airplane. It also talks about things like airworthiness directives compliance and also airworthiness limitations. Real quick, can you describe what airworthiness limitations are?
Yes, airworthiness limitations are an absolute requirement. Up there with the level of an AD, an airworthiness directive. And it was probably a good part of the way through my career that I started learning more about these. And I like the updated maintenance manuals because you can count on it that in Chapter 4, you are going to find the airworthiness limitations. And I think this is a huge confusing factor when it comes to small airplane maintenance. Chapter 4, airworthiness limitations, they are absolutely required to be complied with. Chapter 5 is not absolutely required for Part 91 airplanes. If you get into 135, where the op specs say that you will comply with all the recommendations, that's a different thing. But Chapter 4 has the airworthiness limitations, and they are established by the FAA that that is something that has to be done on the airplane. So you don't have a choice. You can also have airworthiness limitations embedded into an ICA, or instructions for continued airworthiness. So when you, we talked about a modification, like a major alteration, and when you file that form 337, one of the things it wants to see on there is where to find the ICA, the instructions for continued airworthiness. And not always, but sometimes there is an airworthiness limitation section in there. And so when there is, that's something that can easily be overlooked, and we need to make sure that we are complying with those items as well.
Yeah, it's one of those caveats that can be overlooked quite often. Let's take an airplane as an example. You talk about airworthiness limitations, Chapter 4 of your maintenance manual. Cirrus airplane says piston single, but there are, I don't remember offhand, but there's probably 7 or 8 things in the airworthiness limitations section for Chapter 4. You know, things like the parachute repack, the rocket motors, the line cutters, things like that. So basically, I guess if we're going to summarize this, we can say we've got, hey, we have the required inspections, we have airworthiness directives that we need to comply with, and then, of course, we have airworthiness limitations that we need to comply with. So if we're putting this kind of stuff in a checklist, those are the three big things that people should be aware of. Now let's talk real quick about 91.405, which is getting discrepancies repaired or addressed and then making a logbook entry. I'm sure you've seen it, Dean, where there's maintenance done to an airplane or something installed on the airplane and there's no logbook entry for it. Technically, that's not legal, right? That's undocumented maintenance. So, you know, tell us, do you have any stories about that or anything you wanted to mention about the importance of getting squawks fixed, making a logbook entry?
I don't have a specific story that comes to mind, but I would also have to say that when you sent me the information for this interview, it was like you gave me my homework, so I had to go digging. But that was good. That was good for me. And this 91405 is something that I had not looked at in, I don't even remember the last time. Mm. And it was a good reminder for me that it's actually a required thing to fix items that break in between the inspections, unless you are able to keep it deactivated and properly placarded according to that regulation. I forget the exact regulation, but that's in there as well. So yeah, that was a good review. And that is definitely one of those items that gets overlooked, because many times on these Part 91 airplanes, people do not fix things along the way. They tend to, unless it's something that feels urgent to them, they oftentimes wait until the inspection and get it done then. Mm-hmm. So that was definitely a good one to review.
Absolutely. You know, the owner should be aware of these things, because at the end of the day, if something were to happen or the FAA were to do some sort of ramp check or investigation, they might, you know, be asking you some questions about these things. And so it's good to have somewhat of an idea. Just real quick, discuss 91.409. This is the regulation that talks about the requirements to have specific inspections done. So Dean, you want to tell us a little bit more about 91.409?
Sure. When it comes to the Part 91 plan, which a lot of the GA community is doing just annual inspections, and those are definitely required. But then if you're using an airplane for hire or for flight instruction, then you have to do a next level of inspection, and that is the 100-hour inspection. So that's in addition to the annual. But one of the things about the 100-hour inspection, you cannot substitute that for an annual, but you can do the other way around. An annual will work to satisfy the requirement for the annual or the 100-hour inspection. So what the annual does, it sets the clock again to zero, and then you can go 12 months until the next annual. But the main thing to remember is that flight instruction airplanes and for hire airplanes, they require the 100-hour in addition to the annual inspection.
Perfect. Yeah. So the only thing I would add too is if you have a large airplane over 12,500 pounds or a turbine powered airplane, then additional inspections would be listed in there as well, like your progressive inspection if you're doing something like that, or if you are required to follow the manufacturer's maintenance program under Chapter 5 in the maintenance manual, it would be in that regulation as well. Of course, we all know, well, hopefully we learned in private pilot ground school that we have to make sure that the ELT is not expired, and that's a 91.207, so that's a required inspection, and there's also a requirement to replace it at certain, when the battery says it's expired or if it's got time on it and so on. 91.411 and 413, this is something you'll see, you know, owners will see this in their law books. What's that all about? What's the 91.11 413?
411 and 413 has to do with your pitot-static and transponder checks. And so if you're flying an airplane in instrument conditions, you need to have both of those done. And then as far as the transponder side of things, I've heard the FAA have the position that even if you turn the transponder on and use it, even if you're in VFR, you need to have that done. But yeah, the pitot-static and transponder checks, those are required every 24 calendar months.
Absolutely. And I'm sure you've seen it where there's airplanes flying around. Maybe they're flying under instrument flight rules. Maybe they're not, but they have expired pitot-static checks or transponder checks. And it's just the nature of it, but it's something that should be done. It should be done anyway, every couple of years. So that's another requirement though.
I might add that the 91.411 and 413 pitot-static and transponder checks, I think one reason they tend to get overlooked, Many times it's not intentional. It's just that every 2 years, either the owner or operator or the inspector has to take a look and make sure it's being complied with. So if the owner's not aware of it and the inspector doesn't think to look it up, then it can easily get missed in the standard routine of doing the annual inspection.
That's a great point, and so true. And also the typical way of logging the inspection being completed is not a typical logbook entry. Normally it's a piece of paper or a tag that's stapled to the logbook page. And so for those that aren't knowing what they're looking for, they might not even realize that that's what that is. Dean, we've already covered a lot of ground here, and we've gone through the regs, we've gone through the terminology and who's allowed to work on airplanes. What are some other things that we should be thinking about? Logbook entries is one. We kind of touched on that a little bit, but you know, the importance of maintaining and retaining certain maintenance records, not only to track the airworthiness of the airplane, but also to maintain the value of the airplane. Any advice or suggestions or ideas or thoughts about maintenance records?
Well, we covered what needs to be included in a maintenance record: the description, the date, and the signature and certificate of the person approving it. Those are important to keep because, as you mentioned, if there are any maintenance records that are missing for an airplane, then that can drastically affect the value of the airplane when you go to sell it. If so, every now and then you come across an airplane that it'll say all the records before this date are missing. Well, that's a big problem because you have no idea about a lot of the history of that airplane, which brings up another really good point. And that is that as soon as possible, it's a really good idea to go ahead and digitize all the previous maintenance records, because then if you lose the physical copies, you are able to still have the digital copies of those. So, and some people take the stance to say that don't ever take your physical maintenance records to the shop, because they might lose them. And there's probably some valid point to that. But the main thing is make sure you keep up with them in some way or another. And having digital copies is a good way. And then also it's really important to also keep up with, there's regulations for keeping up with the aircraft total time, the times on the engine and the prop, and in the case of a helicopter, the rotor, and life limited parts, times since overhaul, and different things like that, and also the AD status and the 337s. But maintenance records are really, really important, and they are a very significant part of the value of an airplane. So it's good to take really good care of them. I also have another thing that I like is when somebody brings me maintenance records, I prefer to have everything I need, but I also prefer not to have more than I need. And so many of the maintenance records bags come into the shop and they've got all kinds of extraneous stuff that doesn't need to be there. There might be some fuel receipts and there'll be some tags from ancient altimeters and DGs that were put in the airplane from 1970, 60, whatever. And I just don't want to see all that stuff. So I do want to see the current record. Well, actually all the maintenance records if possible, because if I'm doing it the first time, I need to go back and make sure all the ADs are up to date. But if you have a lot of stuff that is not useful, it's going to take your A&P, your inspector, extra time to sort through that stuff. So maintenance records should be complete and they should be well organized. That's what I would end with.
Wow. That's really, really well said and excellent advice. Couldn't agree with you more on that. And I hope our listeners are taking that seriously. It's a significant point for sure. So we've talked a lot about required items, inspections, and so on. What are some things that are not required to be replaced, but a good idea to do on a somewhat of a routine basis? Things like the magnetos or even an engine overhaul. And engine overhauls in most cases aren't required, but magnetos, props, alternators, spark plugs, you know, we see all these kinds of recommendations made either by the manufacturer or maybe by some of the service bulletins or, you know, magazine articles, whatever it might be. What is your opinion on those things? And at, you know, what kind of interval should people be thinking about replacing these things, or should they be doing it at all?
Yes, I think there are some things that are far more important than others to be overhauling or having inspected at regular intervals. And one of those, I just this week put four magnetos back on a Piper Seminole because I was very pleased that the owners chose to have us send those out. I don't remember how many hours were on them. I think it was maybe 600-ish hours in that neighborhood. And mags, the recommendation is to have them either have a 500-hour inspection or overhaul every 500 hours. And I think that's an excellent one because they have a lot of parts inside the magneto that can wear, and you never know when you're going to have a problem. So if you do the 500-hour inspections, you're going to have a much more reliable set of magnetos. I think that's a really important one. And as far as alternators, I think that's another one that is pretty important to not wait until your standard, say, 1600 or 2000 hour TBO time. I think it's good to choose an interval that you either take the alternator off and have it sent out or you change it. I love the alternators that have the capability of removing the brushes externally without even removing the alternator. I just took a set out here week. And the brush length was okay, but the little wire lead between the brush and the end was starting to fray. And so I recommended to the guy that as soon as reasonable, he should have those replaced. But alternators would be in that category also. And then there's other things as well. Some of the items I think can adequately be monitored and changed on condition or when they fail. Like some people will change out, for example, vacuum pumps at regular intervals. It depends on your situation, I suppose. And if you have a backup, if you have a backup system, I would tend to just change those on condition because you never know when one of these dry vacuum pumps is going to fail. So probably the best thing to do is just take a look at what kinds of things have been problems in the past, and mags and alternators definitely have. And do as much reading and education of yourself as you can, and then make the best decision that you can for your situation.
Yeah, that's excellent advice. And I think that at the end of the day, the decision is made by you, the owner, not the mechanic. So the mechanic can give you recommendations, perhaps, you know, maybe a squawk list or, hey, you know, this has is due for overhaul or whatever. But it's up to you to make that determination and not to be pressured one way or the other. And I agree with you. Magnetos is a big one because there's so many moving parts. I totally agree with that. And same with the alternators. What about how often should people be doing oil changes? You know, there's different theories out there for that, and it might depend on if it's turbocharged or not. But what's your opinion and advice on oil changes?
Yeah, I think a pretty typical interval for oil changes is every 50 hours. as long as you have one of the full flow oil filters. And I think that's a good interval for most airplanes that are not turbocharged. We tend to change the oil in the turbocharged engines every 25 hours, as long as the operator agrees to that. And the turbocharged engine is going to have a little more, probably, well, that oil gets a lot hotter when it goes through the turbo. And so we tend to change those a little more frequently. So I think that's a good interval for oil changes, 50 hours.
Absolutely. That sounds good. Now, you brought up a term a little bit ago, TBO. Can you explain to folks what TBO is, and is that mandatory or is it just a recommendation?
TBO stands for time between overhaul. And one of the main items that that is used for is engines. And so the manufacturer establishes a recommended time between overhaul. And on a lot of the engines, it will tend to be somewhere in the 1500 to 2000 hour range, give or take. For Part 91 operators, that is a recommendation. It is not a requirement. And in today's world, I think we have much better capability of reliably running these engines past TBO because we have a lot of things today that we did not have, say, 50 years ago. We have the ability to do oil analysis and see what's in the oil. We can do bore scope inspections, which is fantastic. I love that. We can monitor the oil consumption. We can check the oil filter and screen. We can monitor the color of the oil. We have engine monitoring systems, which are also another great thing that we have. So I think with all these things, as long as it is done safely and wisely, we can definitely run these engines past TBO.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great point. So the opposite of complying with TBO would be on condition. So can you just explain what do you mean by on condition?
On condition would be that we continue to keep that part in service until either we choose to change it or it exhibits some sort of indication that it's needing overhaul. Like all the things that we just talked about with monitoring the engine condition, many times something will happen that will give us an indication that that engine needs to be overhauled. So for example, you may be accustomed to putting a quart of oil in your engine every 12 hours. And then over a period of time, if you get to where you're adding a quart every hour, then you know that something has really changed. You might want to look into that and see why that is. So on condition just means that you're changing it when you see a need to do so rather than on a pre-established amount of hours or calendar time.
Yep, absolutely. Makes perfect sense. Dean, we've talked about a lot of different things so far. Choosing a good maintenance shop, though, is important. So what are some things that people can do to qualify a maintenance shop to ensure they're a good fit for them and for their airplane?
Well, one of the best things, I think, is just stop by for a visit and see what kind of vibe you get when you walk in the place and when you talk with not only the manager, but if they will allow you to, maybe speak with one or two of the mechanics there and just kind of see if you like the place. If you do, then consider doing a small thing with them rather than dropping your airplane off for the annual inspection. Maybe have them do an oil change or a tire change or some, or you have a couple of squawks you need fixed, something like that. Something where if something goes terribly wrong, it's not going to be catastrophic for you. But I would say those are a couple of things in the beginning. And then also, even if you do end up doing an annual inspection, one of the things that tends to happen is people will take their airplane to a shop and they won't hear from the shop until it's time to pick the airplane up. And you pick the airplane up and you get the invoice and you look at it and you are absolutely shocked because you had no idea that instead of $4,000, you're paying $10,000 for your annual inspection. And this should not happen, both for the perspective of the airplane owner and for the shop. And I just see it almost everywhere in life, this massive lack of communication that happens. And it's terrible. So if you do take your airplane into a new shop for an annual inspection, one of the best things you can do is say, I would like you to inspect, first of all, get an estimate as to what the inspection is going to cost for the base price. And then, you know, they're probably going to find a list of squawks that need to be fixed. and get an estimate for, have them do the inspection and then send you a list of squawks with estimates for parts and labor to fix those so that you are kept up to speed along the way without getting that terrible sticker shock in the end.
Such great advice. Having that open line of communication is so important. And that's something maybe, you know, a great question to ask the shop that you're looking at maybe bringing your airplane to is, what is your process or procedure for, you know, getting work authorizations and getting quotes? And do you guys work the squawks as you're doing the annual, or do you do the annual first and then work squawks after I approve the list? Because, I mean, there's so many different ways to do it, but you just want to make sure that everyone's on the same page. And I don't like this idea of you drop the airplane off, it's there for 2 weeks, you do the annual, and then you call the customer and say, hey, we're done. Here's the bill. I like this idea of calling, you know, maybe not every day, but, you know, giving regular updates to let them know, hey, we're still working on your airplane. Everything's going well. Here's what we found so far. You know, what do you want to do about this? What do you want to do about that? I just think that little shift can just remove so much complication and anxiety and that sticker shock factor for folks.
Yeah. Hey, I wanted to add one thing, if you don't mind, too.
Sure.
And that is, one of my favorite things to do is that when I go through an inspection and I come up with a list of squawks, if it's one that there are a lot of items and it's maybe more than what they were expecting, I really like it if the airplane owner can stop by the shop and we can actually walk around the airplane and look at all the stuff that we're talking about. I find that to be really helpful both to me and to the airplane owner. So that's something also. Ask them in the beginning, say, once you come up with this list of squawks, what it is you're telling me about. And if you have a response where they say, oh no, we don't really like airplane owners in our shop, then I would really consider taking it somewhere else, because there should be no reason that they can't walk around the airplane and show you the things that they found and why they need to be fixed. And so I've found that to be really, really helpful in those situations.
No, that's another great point. As they say, pictures are worth 1,000 words, right? So that's a
absolutely
good example of
yes.
that. Are there any other questions that people should be asking the shop when they're qualifying them?
Well, everybody wants to know what it's going to cost. So certainly check in and find out what the hourly labor rate is for the shop. And then many times shops will have a base price, either as a dollar number or a number of hours that you can multiply by the shop labor rate in order to get that base price for an inspection. So for example, let's say you have a Cessna 172, it's likely going to be somewhere in the 15-hour range, and a typical amount for a good maintenance shop these days will be $100 an hour-ish. I think our current labor rate is $90 an hour, but I've heard of rates of $100 and more around the country these days. So figure $1,500 minimum for a Cessna 172, whereas if you're looking at something like a Bonanza, you might be looking at more like 30 hours, so $3,000 for a base annual inspection amount, and then you have squawks on top of that. So that would be good to know in the beginning. And then, like you said, how do you work your process? Do you do the inspection and then come up with a list and let me know? Or do you fix things along the way? And it's probably best to do the inspection, make the list, communicate, and then fix the items. But there are occasionally things like, for example, if you need to send the magnetos out for 500-hour inspection and you know that on the front end, you might want to get those off the first day or two and send them out so that that can be in process and then continue on with the inspection. So those are a couple things.
Yeah, that's excellent. Excellent. And true. What about turnaround times? I've seen it where people bring their airplane to the shop and then it sits out in the ramp for 2 weeks. They get the inspection done in a week, but it sits out for 2 weeks. So from drop off to take home, you know, three, four, 5 weeks go by. Is that a question owners should be asking a shop? You know, hey, what's your turnaround time? How fast can I expect this airplane to come back to me?
Absolutely. That's a question the owner should ask. Yes. Every now and then we have a situation that works out something like that, hopefully not that severe, but yes, it does happen, because what can happen is some previous work takes longer than the shop thought it would. And so the next airplane doesn't come in as soon as we hoped it would. And then it goes from there. But yes, good communication along the way between the airplane owner and the shop is very, very important. As far as the amount of time it takes to get it in and out the door, that really depends on what needs to be done and what is found. So it's challenging to schedule sometimes. I have heard that a lot of shops across the country, especially the good shops, are really, they have a ton of work to do these days. And we've been good and busy at Classic Aviation. We try to get people in as soon as reasonably possible, but it's always good to plan ahead. And if you want to get your airplane in a good shop, it's a really good idea to plan a few months in advance for the annual inspection. One of my favorite annual inspections is coming up on Monday. And it's our local couple, Leon and Winnie Jo Henning. They have this pristine Citabria. And I'll be disappointed if we don't get it in and out in one day, because that's the way they operate. They have it. It is in just immaculate condition. The records are well kept. And the AD records are consolidated. We've been doing it for many years, and they've already rolled they have a big toolbox and also a gurney with a whole bunch of tools and supplies on it. And they already rolled that into the shop yesterday. Wow. So that it's ready to go for Monday. But that is like probably the one annual inspection of the year that I can do in one day. Most of them are not that way.
That is fascinating.
So most of the airplanes, if I get them in and out in 1 week, that would be considered quickly. Mm-hmm. And then it just depends on what it is from there.
Interesting. Getting your airplane done in one day, that's a miracle. But it goes back to the owner, though, being proactive, because it makes everybody's life easier so that everyone can use their time more efficiently and effectively. And that's how that can be done. And I guess that's a good segue for my next question. What are some things owners could be doing to save them some money when it comes to maintaining their airplane?
Well, definitely some of those things that we talked about in the very beginning, and that is learning all we can. The more you know, the better off you're going to be. And then getting involved in the maintenance, if you're so inclined, you can save some money there. But I would also say, don't expect to save money the first time you do an owner-assisted annual inspection, because you have to get used to how it is to work with your A&P, with your inspector. And there's probably going to be a fair amount of discussing things, which is going to eat up a lot of time. So the first time around, you probably won't save much. But if you can get in a good routine where you do a lot of the opening up, the closing, the lubing, and whatever else you can take care of, then in subsequent years, you may be able to save some money on that. And I would say in those subsequent years, that's something that you should talk about. You should ask in advance. Don't ask on the tail end when you get the invoice, can you take off X amount of dollars? Ask that in the beginning.
Yes.
Before you start the inspection, how much can I save if I help with the inspection and I do these items? So back to the communication thing, very important.
Absolutely. That's great advice. What's your opinion on owners buying their own parts? I know there's folks that think that they can get the parts cheaper if they buy it themselves. That's true in some cases. But, you know, just generally, what's your opinion on owners supplying their own parts?
Yeah, this can be a sticky situation because it just depends on how things go. I know for me, for example, one time my daughter had her car has a turbocharger in it and her turbo failed. And we love our auto mechanic. He is fantastic. And he's okay with us bringing parts. And it was going to be really expensive. And I think actually Maria, my wife, had really dug into that. And she found a better price on that thing. And he was okay with us taking it down there. Now, I do like to also buy parts from him as well. And if he recommends something, then I'm likely to go with his recommendation. So I like the flexibility of owners being able to do some research, and if they find a way to save some money, I think that should be considered an option. However, what you don't want to do is ask your shop or mechanic to research the part numbers and give you the part numbers so that you can then go buy them cheaper. You're kind of taking advantage of them. So yes. If they're going to be doing work for you and they're spending their time doing research related to getting parts, then you should feel some sort of loyalty to be able to support them and buy the parts through them. So if you're kind of on your own as far as coming up with the parts and you communicate it in advance, then if you do research, sometimes you can save a substantial amount of money by buying, for example, an alternator or a magneto from one place as opposed to another. So it's kind of a mixture, and you just have to be careful about your situation and make sure you're not doing something to turn off your shop or your mechanic.
I think that's really good advice, and that's an aspect of it that I didn't think about too much because I haven't, I guess, come across that, but that's a great point, and I can see that happening. I can absolutely see that happening where, you know, you're asking the mechanic what the part numbers are, and they're like, okay, well, it's this part number, and then they come back to the shop 3 days later with the part. Here it is. Like, oh, okay. But one thing that I think people really need to keep in mind is that you can't just go down to Ace Hardware and get replacement parts for your airplane light bulbs and stuff. How do we make sure that we're putting the correct parts into the airplane? Approved parts. What are the approved parts, first of all, and how do we get them?
Well, one of the main sources that we have for finding parts is, first of all, to find the part number. So the manufacturer is going to have an IPC, an illustrated parts catalog for the airplane. So typically, if we find the part number in there, then we can research and find the places that, and if we buy it by the part number, then usually we can count on the fact that it's going to be a genuine aircraft part. And many times, if it's a part that is something substantial, it's going to come with some kind of paperwork, a data tag, an 8130 form, or something like that, so that the FAA, especially for repair stations, wants to be able to see some form of traceability of where that part came from. So that would be a good thing to have, some kind of paperwork that comes with it.
Perfect. Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. Traceability, particularly, you know, serialized parts, that's super important. Whether or not it's a big airplane, small airplane, you get it yourself, the mechanic gets it, there should be some traceability there. Do you have any thoughts about hardware? Can we go down to Ace and get a bag of screws, or do we need to use something different?
Some of the screws at the hardware store probably would fit in your airplane, but that's generally frowned upon. So every now and then, you know how it is on especially sheet metal screws. Sometimes when the hole gets worn out, people will get these massive, like typically you have the number 6, number 8, and number 10 size sheet metal screws. And every now and then you see these big honking quarter inch sheet metal screws and that type of thing.
Yeah.
And so that's probably generally frowned on. If it gets that big, then maybe it needs some kind of other repair. And then it's really important also to distinguish between, is this a structural or non-structural piece of hardware? So if, for example, if you have a structural, say 1032 size screw, then you wouldn't want to go down to the hardware store and get a 1032 screw of any other type and just stick in there. So that's an important dividing line also. Is it a structural piece of hardware or considered non-structural? For example, one item that would be structural screws would be, I think, of the ones that hold the Bonanza ailerons on. And so you have two on the top and two on the bottom of each hinge fitting, so a total of 8 on each aileron. Those need to be structural screws. As much as possible, even with the sheet metal screws, it's good to get all that hardware from aviation supply stores.
That's the easiest way to do it, I think. I mean, really. There's some great websites out there that break it down by,
yes,
by part number or by hardware type or material or the spec, the AN or the MS spec or the NAS spec or whatever. So that makes it a lot easier. And those are the things that you need to be trying to get are the industry standard hardware for sure.
You just reminded me of something. I'll send you some pictures. So my friend from Florida flew up here in his Baron. And it was great to see him the other day. And so I walked out to his airplane, and me being an inspector, I just poked around his airplane to see what I could see. And back on the tail cone, there was a screw that was just like you said, it was sticking out a bit. And so I got my screwdriver and I thought, well, let me tighten this thing up. Uh-huh. Well, it would not tighten. And so then the reason was I backed it out, and you can probably guess there was a sheet metal screw rammed in this fine thread nut plate or whatever was in there. And so I took the sheet metal screw out, got my 1032 tapped it out, and then put a machine screw in there. It was exactly what you're saying. And I see that so frequently all over the place on airplanes.
It makes it. If you're pulling panels off real quick, you do a maintenance event or inspection, and you're going to reinstall everything, and then the screws aren't threading in right, and it's because, well, they've been putting the wrong thread screwed in there to begin with. Well, we kind of just mentioned a couple things here. For those owners that are trying to be more involved with their maintenance and do some preventative maintenance and maybe owner-assisted stuff, what are some tools that owners should have in their toolbox and maybe some inventory too they might want to consider for preventative maintenance and just general quick little things they want to do on the airplane when they're on the road or what have you?
I would say mainly a basic set of tools if you are interested in doing some maintenance on your airplane. So that would include some straight and Phillips screwdrivers. I have a ratcheting screwdriver that goes both directions, and I love that thing. Mm-hmm. Might be careful about if you're going to do much of that. If you get a cheap one, it's going to function like a cheap one. And if you get a good one, it'll be reliable for many years. And that's true for a lot of the tools. You probably should have a decent set of wrenches and sockets. I mostly on airplane, on these small airplanes, I use largely my quarter inch drive stuff, but at the same time, you may want also a 3/8 drive ratchet and maybe some extensions. And especially if you're going to be doing spark plug work, it's worthwhile to have a spark plug socket. Mm-hmm. And they're not all that expensive, and they are specially designed for the spark plugs. So whatever you need for that. And then I have two sizes of torque wrenches, a small quarter inch drive one that goes up to 200 inch pounds. And then my 3/8 drive one goes up to 1000 inch pounds. And that covers pretty much everything that you need most of the time on these small airplanes. So torque wrenches are good. As far as inventory, it's good to have one or two extra spark plugs that you carry in your airplane. You never know when you might have a spark plug fail. Mm. So that's a good thing to have. And then a few of the washers, the spark plug gaskets, it's good to install new ones every time you put the spark plugs back in the engine because they are soft and annealed and they make a really good seal. So that's important. You might also consider carrying a couple of types of pliers and also safety wire tools. Those are good to have. So that would be sufficient to carry in the airplane. Those are just a couple thoughts. There's probably a lot more you could do.
I think what you covered is perfect. I mean, that's what you would need to do a majority of the preventative maintenance on an airplane. And you don't need to necessarily have more than that. I'm totally with you on that spark plug socket. For a long time, I didn't have one. I just used a 7/8 impact socket, and that worked most of the time, but not 100% of the time. Not that long ago, I went out to Spruce and got a couple of spark plug sockets, and they work 100% of the time. So that's good advice. And, you know, they're made for that specific job for airplane spark plugs. And so that's, I guess, another point. You can't just get a car spark plug socket. That's not going to work. You got to get an airplane spark plug socket from Spruce or wherever.
Yes. But
well, Dean, we've covered a lot of ground together. Do you have anything else you want to add or anything else you want to tell folks before we wrap up?
Yeah, one thing just came to me, and that is that if you are someone that's interested in maintenance on your airplane, keep in mind that even though you cannot, unless you have the certificate, you can't sign off, for example, an annual inspection. There is nothing preventing you from getting the annual inspection checklist and walking around your airplane and looking at all these things. Mm. So consider doing that. You can't sign it off as the return to service, but you can sure take that form and go around your airplane and look at a lot of different things. And one thing that I think is probably something that most owners don't really think about is checking your magneto timing. If you learn how to do that, when you service your spark plugs, you could check your mag timing. Now, if it needs to be adjusted, then that is maintenance that you need to have your A&P do or be supervised by your A&P. But you can absolutely check it and make sure that it's where it needs to be. So that's one little thing that I think of.
Well, first of all, I love that idea of taking that annual inspection checklist and going through the airplane, just seeing what it all is all about. Because you're right, nothing stops folks from doing that. And that's a really great idea. Where might people find the annual inspection checklist? Some people might not know where to get it.
Typically in the aircraft maintenance manual, it will be in, it's going to be in, if it's laid out by the standard ATA code, it'll be chapter 5. You'll find that in the maintenance manual. But honestly, likely you can just do some Googling online and you'll probably come up with a checklist somewhere that you can print out or put in your iPad or something like that.
Perfect. That's great. You mentioned a little while ago when we were talking about tools, safety wire tools. So tell us a little bit more about some of the resources that you have so that folks that are interested in learning more about preventative maintenance or maintenance on the airplane, tell us about your podcast, your courses, and some of your other resources that you have.
Sure. Thanks. I appreciate that. When I started the podcast, I set up a website and it is over at airplaneownermaintenance.com. And that is where I put the show notes for my podcast episodes. And one time I had somebody tell me that you have good pictures. So I try to put in pictures of various different things I'm working on. So feel free to take a look at that. And as far as the podcast episodes, if you need to get to a particular one, you can just type in airplaneownermaintenance.com/whatever the number is, and it should take you right to it. As far as the safety wiring, I have learned a ton about that over the years. And I think because of a ton of practice, I've gotten really good at it. And so it makes me not very gracious or happy with less than stellar safety wiring. And I see it a lot. And the owner of Classic Aviation many years ago, he thought I was using too much safety wire. And I was in my beginning years and practicing, and I think he asked me one day, "Do you have stock in the safety wire company?" Like I was using too much of it. Uh-huh. So I've learned a lot since then. And some years ago, I decided to produce a safety wire pro. If you just type that at Google, it'll probably come up, and you can find it on my website on the store page. And then if you research it, you can find it. I've got it linked also in some of my YouTube videos, but it's a course where you can go through and learn all about safety wiring and how to do it really, really well. I see poor safety wiring both from airplane owners and from fellow mechanics. So I think it's a big need. So I produced that one. And then here not too long ago, I also did another video course about servicing landing gear shock struts because I did a podcast episode early on about that, and it surprised me that there was a lot of interest in that. So I went ahead and did one of those. And then here's a free resource that if people are interested in bore scoping, if you go to airplaneownermaintenance.com/exhaust valves, it'll take you to a form where you can fill in your email address and it'll be sent to you. And that is, It's a resource to help you know what to look for when you poke the bore scope down in a cylinder, especially when you're looking at the exhaust valves, because I have just been so fascinated with finding burning exhaust valves early in the process and then being able to take action on that. So feel free to take advantage of that resource. And then I also do some other work, and all this is on the store page on my website, but I do logbook records review work. I do bore scope photo evaluations. And then if anybody wants to do some one-on-one consulting, we can also arrange that. So those are some of the things that I have going on.
Wow. Just some of the things. It's so many great resources that you have, Dean. And I hope that everyone goes and checks out your podcast if they haven't already. And I'll put links to everything you just mentioned into the show notes. I remember buying the Safety Wire course shortly after you put it out. And just because I wanted to make sure that there's no other tricks that I need to know. And I learned so much from doing that. And I think my safety wiring has gotten better from it. I feel like a safety wire to us as mechanics is similar to stitching for a nurse or a doctor. Some people do it really, really well, and other people do not. And it's a skill yes. that you develop over time. I highly recommend people to check that out because it's so interesting. And it does take some practice, but your course is a great way to learn how to do it right so you can practice it correctly as well. There's always so much to learn. So I highly recommend people check these resources out. The Borescope resource as well. I have that saved on my computer. I reference it occasionally when I'm maybe not sure about what I'm looking at. So everyone needs to definitely check those resources out because they're extremely valuable.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Of course. You mentioned your website. Are there any other ways people can reach out to you directly if they have other questions or they want to speak with you about some things or set up that consulting call with you or what have you?
There's a place on the website you can do that, but you can also feel free to send me an email to dean@airplaneownermaintenance.com. And then also I have a little thing on the website that's kind of one of my favorite ways when people get in touch with me because I can hear their voice. Mm. It's a little tab on the side of the website page. And if you click it, you can just leave me a voice message on there. So I always love to hear from people in that way as well.
Awesome. Well, we'll put that into the show notes as well as with your email address. Do you have anything else you want to share with us?
Yeah, I think we covered a ton of territory there, Adam. So just to finish up, I just want to tell you that I really appreciate you and what you're doing. You have from the very beginning been such a fascinating young man to me in all that you're doing. I appreciate your military service. I really do. And I appreciate the contribution that you are making to general aviation these days. And I enjoy referring people to you. When I find somebody that could use your services for inspection services and beyond, then I always do that with great confidence. So yeah, thank you so much for everything you're doing.
Well, thank you, Dean. I really appreciate your feedback and your kind words, and likewise to you. I look up to you. I learn a lot from you, and I appreciate what you're doing, and I look forward to continuing our relationship and continuing to learn more and more about maintenance from you and aviation and all sorts of other things that you talk about, and I look forward to a continued friendship with you as well. So thank you for taking time to come on the podcast and spending some time with me and our listeners, and I look forward to having you on again in the not-so-distant future.
Well, thanks, Adam. And one more thought, your last couple episodes, and this is something you do, you make us think about a given type of airplane that maybe we hadn't thought about. And just yesterday, I was listening to your recent one about the PA-46 airplanes. Mm. And man, that guy, he was super great
yes.
at making you think that this PA-46 was the best airplane ever. So even though he had that terrible thing happened with the engine overhaul. Wow. Yeah. That was quite a story, but it's really great what you're doing to make us aware of some of the airplanes out there that might be otherwise considered a bit of an oddball. Mm. So that's fun.
Well, cool. I'm glad you enjoyed that. And I appreciate that feedback. And I agree that he surprised me with his stories he was a great, great listen. I enjoyed speaking with him too. And hopefully we'll have more stories and folks on to talk about their airplane, because the PA-46 is definitely, like you say, it's kind of an oddball. It's overlooked by a lot of folks more often than not. So whatever we can do to bring more awareness to all these airplanes, and you do the same thing, you know, when you're talking about the airplanes that you're working on in the shop and some of the folks that you've talked to. So it's definitely interesting, and there's so much to learn still. It's very humbling as well.
Absolutely.
Cool. Well, Dean, thanks again for your time. We'll catch up with you next time.
All right. Sounds great, Adam. Thank you so much.
Wow, what an amazing guy. I really hope that you enjoyed the interview I had with Dean as much as I did. And as airplane owners, it's critical that we take our responsibilities seriously and learn as much as we can about maintenance. Dean is certainly an excellent resource for becoming more savvy with your maintenance. So I put all the links mentioned in this episode, including Dean's podcast, his borescoping guide, and of course, his courses, Safety Wire Like a Pro and Strut Servicing, on our show notes page at airplaneintelpodcast.com. Just click on episode 91. Well, that's going to cover it for us on this episode. Thank you so much for spending time with us today. I greatly appreciate you and your continued support. As we get ready for the holidays, I wish you and your family a happy, healthy, and joyful holiday season, and of course, a safe and prosperous new year. And until next time, keep the dirty side down, and we'll see you next year.
Thanks for listening to the Airplane Intel Podcast. If you liked what you just heard, we hope that you'll subscribe to our show and leave us a rating or review. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching Airplane Intel. To access show notes, episode archives, and other free resources, visit us at airplaneintelpodcast.com. To get a 60-day free trial of CoFlight, head over to coflight.com and use the coupon code PREBUY. Also, if you'd like to support our show, visit us on patreon.com/prebuyguys. And remember, owning an airplane doesn't have to be hazardous to your wealth.